A man, a painter coming into some fame, crossed her palm that she might read his. She told him he would die at his own hand, and he laughed. But the next time I escaped to Knight's doorstep, Hyacinth told me that the man had died of poisoning, from wetting the tip of his paintbrush with his tongue. Thus was my secret life out from beneath the eye of Sirius House. The Dalwayne's guard, of course, knew where to find me. If Hyacinth's trail of mischief was not easily traced, they merely did as I had come to do, and asked about of the brothel keepers and at the wine shops. Someone inevitably knew where to find us. It came to be something of a game, to see how long I might remain at my freedom before I was caught up by a gauntleted hand and slung ignominiously over the pommel of a saddle to be returned to Sirius House. The guard, I think, saw it as such, for life in the night court was dull for a swordsman. I at least offered a challenge, albeit a small one. The Dalwayne was another matter. After my third such escapade, she was rightfully infuriated and ordered a chastening. Straight from the pommel, struggling and squirming, I was brought to the courtyard before her. I had never seen, before that, a whipping post used for its purpose. Other occasions blur before that vivid memory. The Dalwayne sat in her chair, looking above my head. The guardsman who had brought me hither forced me to my knees, grasping my wrists together in one hand. In a trice my wrists were bound above me to the iron ring atop the post. The Dalwayne looked away. Someone behind me caught the nape of my gown and tore it open, all down the back. I remember the air was warm and scented with flowers, a touch moist from the fountains that played freely there. I felt it upon the bare skin of my back. The marble flagstones were hard beneath my knees. It was not a hard whipping, as such things go. Mindful of the fact that I was a child, the Dalwayne's chastiser used a soft deerskin flogger and a delicate touch, pizzicato style. But child I was, and my skin was tender, and the lash fell like a rain of fire between my naked shoulders. The first touch was the most exquisite, the fine thongs laying rivulets of pain coursing across my skin, awakening a fiery shudder at the base of my spine. Once, twice, thrice, I might have thrilled for days at the ecstatic pain, nursing the memory of it. But the chastiser kept on, and the rivulets swelled to streams, rivers, a flood of pain, overwhelming and drowning me. It was then that I began to beg. I cannot recall now such things as I said. I know that I writhed, bound hands extended in a rigid plea, and wept, and pledged my remorse, and promised never to defy her again. And still the lash fell, over and over, inflaming my poor back, until I thought the whole of it was afire. Adepts of the house stood by and watched, faces schooled not to show pity. The Dalwayne herself never looked, that fine ancient profile all she would give me. I wept and pleaded, and the blows fell like rain, until a warm languor suffused my body, and I sagged against the post, humiliated and beaten. Only then was I released and taken away, and my wheels tended, whilst I felt fine and sore and drowsy in all of my parts, grievously punished. "It's a sickness in your blood," Hyacinth told me knowledgeably, when next I escaped to Knight's doorstep. We sat on the stoop of his building in Rue Coupole, sharing a bunch of stolen grapes between us and spitting out the pips into the street. "That's what my mother says." "Do you think it's true?" I had come ever since the painter's death to share the quarter's solemn awe of Hyacinth's mother's prophetic gift. "Maybe." He spat a pip in a meditative fashion. "I don't feel sick." "Not like that." Although he was only a year older than me, Hyacinth liked to act as if he had the wisdom of the ages. His mother was teaching him something of the Dromond, her art of fortune-telling. "It's like the falling sickness. It means a god's laid his hand on you." "Oh." I was disappointed, for this was nothing more than Delaunay had said, only he had been more specific. I had hoped for something more distinctive from Hyacinth's mother. What does she say of my fortune? My mother is a princess of the Tsingani, Hyacinth said in a lofty tone. The Dormond is not for children. Do you think we've time to meddle in the affairs of a fledgling palace whore? No, I agreed glumly. I suppose not.
I was too credulous, Delaunay would tell me later, laughing.
After all, Hyacinth's mother took in washing and told fortunes for rabble far worse situated than any servant of Narmer. It is true I learned that in much Hyacinth was mistaken. Indeed, had he but known, it was forbidden for Tsingani men to attempt to part the veils of the future. What his mother taught him was taboo. Frajna among his people. Maybe when you're older, Hyacinth consoled me, when you've gold to add to her wealth. She tells the innkeepers for silver, I said irritably, and the fiddlers for copper. And you know well any coin I get above my contract will go to pay the markist. And anyway, I'll not formally serve till I've reached womanhood. It's in the guild laws. Maybe you'll bloom early. Unconcerned with my fate, Hyacinth popped a grape into his mouth. I hated him a little then, for being free. Besides, a coin well spent may be returned three times over in wisdom gained. He looked at me out of the corner of his eye, grinning. I had heard him part many a patron from his purse with similar lines. I grinned back then, and loved him for it. Chapter 5. The midwinter mask fell before my 10th birthday, for I was born in the spring, but the Dawane elected that I should be allowed to attend. I was not, it seemed, to leave the night court without seeing it full in all its splendour. Every house has its own mask at some point throughout the year, and each, I am told, is a splendid affair with a worthy history. But the midwinter mask is something different. Its roots are older than the coming of Elowa, for it celebrates the passing of the old year and the return of the sun. Blessed Elowa was so charmed, it is said, by the peasant's simple ritual, but he embraced it as well, as a rite that honoured his mother earth and her solar consort. It has always been the role of Sirius House, the first, to host the midwinter mask. On the longest night, the doors to all the other houses are closed, their walls emptied, for everyone comes to Sirius House. No patrons are welcomed save those who bear the token of Narmer, a gift given only at a Dawane's discretion. Even now, when the night of the 13 houses wanes under the light of profit, the tokens remain another matter, held only by those who lay claim to royal lineage and are deemed worthy of Narmer's embrace. Days before the event, the house was shrouded in mystery and bustle. Mystery, for no one knew who would be chosen from among our ranks to play the key roles in the great mask. The Winter Queen was chosen, always, from among the adepts of Sirius House. The Sun Prince, of course, might be selected from any of the 13 houses, and the competition was fierce. In Knight's doorstep, Hyacinth told me, they lay odds on the choosing. It is said that the Sun Prince brings a year's luck to his house. I know why, now, Delaunay told me. There is an old, old story, older than Elowa, about the Sun Prince wedding the Winter Queen to claim lordship of the land. Such stories, he said, are always the oldest, for they are born of our first ancestors' dreams and the eternal turning of the seasons. Whether or not this is true, I do not know, but I know of a surety that Anarfiel Delaunay was not the only one who knew the story that night. But this was yet to come, and in the preceding days, the mystery-shrouded confines of Sirius House abounded with activity. The doors to the great hall were thrown open, and it was given such a cleaning as was seldom seen. The walls were scrubbed, the colonnades polished, the floor waxed and buffed until it shined like mahogany satin. Every speck of ash was emptied from the massive fireplace, and rickety scaffolding was erected so teams of agile painters' apprentices could cleanse a year's accumulation of soot from the frescoed ceiling.
Slowly the exploits of Narmar brightened, colours emerging fresh and new from beneath the accretion of grime. When the empty and pristine hall was judged ready, it was decorated with fresh white candles, all unlit and smelling of sweet beeswax and great boughs of evergreen. And then the long tables were covered with brilliant white cloths to receive the bountiful feast that was being prepared in the kitchens. Indeed, I was manifestly unwelcome in all my usual haunts, as everyone from the concierge on down to the lowest scullery maid was busy making ready for the midwinter mask. Say what you will of the night court, but no one entered its service without pride. Even the stables were off-limits, as the master of horse supervised through gritted teeth a thorough scouring of the entire premises. If Ganelon de la Courcelle himself, King of Terre d'Ange, were to attend the midwinter mask, and such a thing had happened in other times, he would find his horses better tended than in the royal stables. Of course I had witnessed such preparations before, but this year was different, since I was to attend. Of my erstwhile companions, only the frail beauty Ellen would be in attendance, for Juliet's mark had been bought by Dahlia House, as all had guessed, and the merry Calantia had gone on to foster at Orcus when her 10th birthday had arrived. Ellen's pretty half-brother, Etienne, was too young, and must pass the longest night in the nursery. There were two other new fosterlings, though, whom I'd not met, for Sirius House bought the marks of children from other houses, too. Pale Jacinth, whose blue eyes were almost but not quite too dark for the canon of Sirius, and a boy, Donatien, who never spoke. Like Ellen, they were destined to be initiated into the mysteries of Narmar, and I envied them their surety of place. On the longest night, though, there would be no contracts, no exchange of coin. Among the servants of Narmar and their elect guests, only such liaisons as pleased the fancy would be made. Our role was to adorn the festivities. It is tradition to drink joie on longest night, that clear, heady liqueur distilled from the juice of a rare white flower which grows in the mountains and blossoms amid the snowdrifts. We were to circulate among the guests, offering tiny crystalline glasses of joie, which we bore on silver trays. Because it is the privilege of Sirius House to elect the Winter Queen, it is the theme we maintain, in costumes of white and silver. I was hoping to see Surya, to show her mine. All four of us were adorned as winter sprites. We wore sheer white tunics of gossamer to mimic the effect of snow drifting in the wind, with dagged sleeves beaded in glass that hung down like icicles when we raised our trays in offering. Simple white dominoes edged in silver, suitable for children, masked our faces, and we wore only a touch of carmine on the lips for colour. An apprentice ribbonaire bound our hair, and did a very fine job too, plaiting our locks with white ribbons to evoke a tumbling fall of snow. But Surya did not come to see us, and it was another adept who gave us instruction in the kitchen. He wore white brocade trimmed with ermine, and the mask of a snow fox rode his brow, snarling above his own eyes. "Like this," he said impatiently, correcting the line of Donatien's arm as the boy lifted his tray. "No, no, smooth, elegant. You're not hoisting tankards in a tavern, boy. What do they teach you in Mandrake House?" What indeed, I wondered. The Dawain's chastiser had been a Mandrake adept. Donatien trembled, and the delicate glasses trembled like chimes on the tray, but he raised it gracefully. "Better," the adept said grudgingly. "And the invocation?" "Joy." It was more breath than utterance, and Donatien looked like he might faint from the effort of it. The adept gave a wry smile. "Such a fragile bloom. Perfect, sweetheart. They'll be marking their calendars until you come of age. All right, then. You'll see that guests are given first offer, and the Dawain second. After that, it's catch as catch can." He turned then to go, drawing down his mask. "But..." It was Jacinth who had spoken. The adept turned, his face now a mystery behind the sly features of the snow fox, dark shadows behind the eye-holes on either side of the sharp, cunning muzzle.
"How will we know?" she asked sensibly. "Everyone's in mask."
"You'll know," said the snow fox, "or And with this none-too-reassuring piece of advice, he left us to the harried direction of the culinary staff. Beyond the doors we heard the trumpets blow, announcing the arrival of the first party. The musicians struck up a processional tune. In the stifling air of the kitchen, the master chef bellowed orders, and people rushed to do his bidding. We four exchanged glances, uncertain.
"For the love of Nama!"
The second assistant sommelier took charge of us, handing us our trays and shoving us toward the door.
"Sirius is making its entrance. Go now, and take your positions along the wall. Wait until all the houses and the first of the guests have entered."
He made a shooing motion.
"Go, go. I don't want to see you back until every glass is empty."
In the great hall, I saw that kneeling cushions had been placed along the wall. We took our positions to wait and had a good view of the procession as it entered between the marble colonnades. The tray was not light, laden with glasses as it was, but I had been trained for this, as we all had. Gazing at the entering celebrants, I soon forgot the strain in my arms and shoulders. I knew the Dawane in an instant as she entered leaning on Jareth's arm. She was masked as a great snowy owl, wearing a vast white-feathered mask that covered the whole of her face. It was rumored, I knew, that this would be her last midwinter mask. Jareth wore an eagle's mask, white feathers flecked with umber. The adepts of Sirius House followed them, a white and silver fantasia of creatures and wintry spirits. I lost count, with the froths of silk and gossamer and silver piping, homed and hooded and masked. And this was only the beginning. All 13 houses made their entrance. Even now, past its heyday, to those who have never seen the night court in all its splendor, I say, I weep for you. I have gone farther than I ever reckoned from my birthplace, and I have attended grand functions at the royal court. But nowhere else have I seen such exaltation in beauty, and beauty alone. It is as nothing else in the world is, quintessentially d'Angeline. If I had been trained by Delaunay then, which I had not, I would have noted and could now recall exactly what the theme of each house was, but some of the highlights remain with me still. Dahlia challenged the sovereignty of Sirius with cloth of gold, and the adepts of Gentian came masked as seers, preceded by incensers of opium. Eglantine House, in its madcap genius, entered as a company of Tsingani, singing and playing and tumbling. The adepts of Alyssum, famed for their modesty, were robed and veiled as Yeshuite priests and priestesses, profanely provocative. Jasmine House flaunted, as ever, the exotica of faraway lands, and their Dawane's young second danced in naught but dusky skin, night-black hair, and a cloud of veils. This was ill-received by Valyrian's Dawane, who had chosen a harem motif for his adepts. But such things are bound to happen. For my part, I was minded of my distantly remembered mother, and then only briefly, for the procession continued. One might suppose, and logically so, that I would be most curious about the adepts of Valyrian House. It was there, as the Dawane had said, that I would have gone, had I not been floored. And curious I was, sufficient that some things I had learned. I yield was the motto of the house. Its adepts were those who had a propensity to find pleasure in the extremity of pain, and were trained in the receiving thereof. Logical enough. But the magnet is drawn to iron. I dismissed the Pasha's dream that was Valyrian House, and thrilled instead to the arrival of the adepts of Mandrake House, arrayed as the court of Tartarus. There, amid all the froth and gaiety of the other maskers, Orcus House, I am minded, had a stunning aquatic theme with mermaids and fantastic sea-beasts. They struck a deliciously sinister note. Black velvet like a moonless night, and silk like a black river under stars. Bronze masks, horned and beaked,
at once beautiful and grotesque. I felt a tremor run through me and heard the crystalline sound of glasses shivering together. Not my tray. I looked, and it was Donatien, his face pale. I pitied his fear and envied it. Then, at last, the procession was ended, and the trumpet sounded again, and the guests entered. Royal or no, they were a motley assortment, relative to the splendour of the night court. Wolves, bears and harts, sprites and imps, heroes and heroines out of legend, though there was no theme to it. Still I could see, once they had entered, that when all began to mingle, it would make for a glorious array. The trumpet sounded once more, and everyone, Dalwains, royalty and adepts alike, drew back along the colonnade, for this sounded the entrance of the Winter Queen. She entered alone, hobbling. It is said that the mask of the Winter Queen was made 400 years ago by Olivier the Oblique, so sublime a master of the craft that no one knew his true features. Of a surety it was old, wafer-thin layers of leather soaked and moulded into the likeness of an ancient crone, painted and lacquered until it marked not life, but the preservation of it. An old grey mare's tail-wig crowned her head, and she was shrouded in grey rags, a dingy shawl wrapped around her shoulders. This, then, was the Winter Queen. Everyone bowed as she entered the great hall, and those of us kneeling bowed our heads. She hobbled to the head of the colonnade, leaning on an old blackthorn staff, and turned to face the crowd. Straightening only slightly, she hoisted her staff aloft. Trumpets blared, people cheered, and the musicians struck up a merry tune. The midwinter mask had begun. As for the Sun Prince, he would come later, or was already here, most likely, but not revealed in his costume. Not until the horologers cried the moment would he emerge to waken the Winter Queen to youth. So it was begun. I rose from my cushion, stiff from kneeling, and began to circulate. We had all of us taken heed of the costumes in the procession. As the Snow Fox had said, it was not so difficult after all. We might not know the players, but the teams were easily identified. "Joy," I murmured, lifting my tray, eyes downcast. Each time a glass was plucked and drained, set down empty. Out of the corner of my eye, I watched the other three, gauging the moment when all of the guests would have been served a single glass of joie. I had a mind to serve the Darwain of Mandrake House, who wore a bronze crown above his mask and carried a cat of nine tails in his right hand. My tray was emptied ere the guests were all served, however, and I had to return to the kitchen, where the anxious second assistant sommelier refilled my tray with tiny glasses of clear elixir. In the great hall, liveried servants had begun the process of carrying out platter after platter of sumptuous food, until the tables fair groaned. I'd had to dodge among them with my tray of joie. In the centre, several couples had begun a pavane, and I could see in a far corner that one of Eglantine House's tumblers was entertaining. Before me was a portly guest who had unwisely chosen to costume himself as the Chevalier of the Rose. I caught a swirl of black velvet and a glimmer of bronze beyond him, and sought to move past, but a strange waistcoat blocked my view. It bore bronze brocade and buttons shaped like silver acorns, and I remembered that its owner was a guest costumed as Faunus. Hiding my annoyance, I murmured a ritual, "Joy," and offered my tray.
"Phaedra."
I knew the voice, a man's rich tenor, at once amused and bored, and looked up startled. Behind the rustic mask, his eyes were grey, flecked with topaz, and the long braid at his back was auburn. "My Lord de Launay."
"Indeed."
Why did he sound so amused?
"I did not think to see you here, Phaedra. You've not turned 10 without telling me, have you?"
"No, my lord." I could feel the blush rising in my face. "The Darwain thought I should be allowed to serve, to see the mask once." He brushed my ribboned hair with his fingertips, adjusting a lock with a critical gaze.
You'll attend as you choose, unless I miss my guess. Though you'll never be a success en masque, my sweet, not with those eyes. Kushiel's dart shall give you away.
I could have stood there forever while he fussed over my appearance. I don't know why. "Is that how you knew me, my lord?" I asked, to keep his attention.
"Not at all. You never looked up."
He grinned then, unexpectedly. Even masked, it made him look younger. He was only in his mid-30s then, I think. I never knew for certain, even when I knew far more than I knew then.
"Think on it, Fedra, and I'll tell you why when next we meet. And keep those dart-stricken eyes open tonight, my sweet. There may be more to see here than paid flagellants with a fetish for black velvet."
With that he plucked a glass from my tray and drained it.
"Joy," he said, setting it back empty, and turned away.
Balancing the tray on one hand, I picked up the glass from which he had drunk and raised it to my lips. With the tip of my tongue, I caught a tiny drop of pure joie remaining at the bottom. The flavour blazed on my palate, clean and spicy, at once icy and burning. Watching him wind through the crowd, I savoured the taste of it and the secret sharing. Then, quick and guilty, I replaced the glass and continued on my rounds. It was on that night that I first began to discern the deeper patterns at work in Terre d'Ange, the swirls and eddies of power and politics that governed our unknowing lives. Despite this encounter, one can hardly say, I think, that it was all due to Delaunay's influence. Surely I would have taken heed, by the stir it created, of what happened later, warning or no. It was yet an hour shy of midnight, by the horologist's calculations, when Prince Baudouin's party arrived. By this time I had lost count of the number of times I had circulated with my silver tray, and the number of times the second assistant, sommelier, had provided me with fresh glasses. We had been granted reprieve in shifts, and given leave to fill our plates at the great tables. I secured for myself a whole capon smothered in grape sauce, a tender slice of venison dressed with currants, and even a small salad of greens, and was well content. I had just resumed my duties when I heard the commotion, a new party arriving, loud and high-spirited. Pushing my way through the crowd, I came upon the forefront of the audience. It was four young men, and from their attire and demeanour alone I could tell they were of royal blood, true scions of Eloa and his companions. "Prince Baudouin," someone said in a tone of hushed awe, and I surmised which was he. Slender and raven-haired, with fair skin and sea-grey eyes, the stamp of House Trevelyan. The others deferred to him, for all that he leaned drunken on the shoulder of a comrade. He wore a mask of Arza, which was surpassingly lovely, though askew on his pure d'Angeline features, and a large velvet hat with a drooping feather. Seeing the gathering crowd, he pushed himself off his companion's supporting arm and raised a goblet in his right hand.
"Joy!"
he shouted, his voice clear and carrying, even slurred with wine.
"Joy to the night court on this longest night!"
To my left I heard the faint sound of trembling crystal. Donatien. He glanced once at me, terrified. "Well then," I thought, "so be it." Squirming past an antlered heart, I approached the prince's party. I could feel the eyes of the night court upon me, and my heart pounded. "Joy," I echoed softly, holding up the tray.
"What's this?"
A grip like a pincer caught my upper arm, fingers digging into flesh, making me gasp. I looked up into the gaze of the prince's companion. He wore a Jagarundi mask, but behind it his eyes shone dark and cruel, smiling. His hair fell straight about his shoulders, a gold so pale it glittered like silver in the candlelight.
"Denis, taste it."
One of the others took a glass from the tray I offered and tossed it down.
"Ow!"
He shook his head, wolf-masked, and smacked his lips.
"Pure joie, Isidore. Have some."
I stood trembling, while the scions of Eloa snatched with greedy hands at my tray. Glass after glass was drained and hurled to smash on the gleaming parquet floor. The prince let loose a laugh, high and wild, like trumpets. His mask rode crooked on his white brow, and I could see a hectic gleam in his eyes.
"A kiss for luck, little joy-bearer," he declared, sweeping me into his arms.
My tray was crushed between us and fell clattering to the floor, more glasses crushed to shards. His lips brushed the corner of mine for one breathless instant, tasting of joie. And then I was cast aside, forgotten, and the prince's party swept onward into the great hall. The man in the Jagarundi mask glanced once my way and smiled his cruel smile. I knelt on the floor, gathering shards of broken glass upon my tray, not heeding the tears in my eyes. Why, I could not even have said, whether it was the kiss or the casting aside that seared my heart. But I was a child, and such things are quickly forgotten. In the kitchen, Jacinth shot me hateful glances, and I remembered only pride that a prince of the royal blood had named me Joy-Bearer and kissed me for luck. Ironic that, as Anarthiel de Launay could have told him, mine was an ill-luck name. If I'd luck to spare, I'd have shared it with him. I could not have known then that I would be there when his luck turned at last. Some would say he was a fool to have trusted Melisande, and perhaps he was. Even so, he would not have seen the other betrayal coming from one he'd known longer. But that night such plots had not even begun to be dreamt. As if the revelry hadn't been in full stride before, it swung into a faster pace. Stately pavans gave way to the galliard, and the antic hay, and the musicians played in a frenzy, faces shining with sweat. So great were the proportions of the mask, it swallowed even the prince's party. I circulated with my tray, dizzy from the noise and heat. The evergreen boughs above the roaring fireplace loosened a piney fragrance. Rising above the olfactory din of 100 competing perfumes and heated flesh, punctuated by the pungent opium smoke of gentian houses in censers. We were running short of glasses. The style of the evening had been set, and I'd no way of counting how many guests and adepts downed their joie and shattered their glasses on the floor, shouting. There were naught any of the four of us could do. We carried on, our trays sparsely laden, while the liveried servants of Sirius House darted amid the crowd with brooms and dustpans. Such were the profundities that occupied my mind when beneath the merry skin of music the slow beat of the tocsin began. It was the longest night. We had almost forgotten, all of us. But the horologists had not. They forget nothing. And the night crier struck the gong at a measured pace, cutting through the din and slowing the revelry. Dancers parted and the floor cleared, celebrants falling back. From behind a screen, the Winter Queen re-emerged, leaning on her blackthorn staff, hobbling to the head of the colonnade. Someone cheered and was silenced. Everyone looked toward the fast-shut doors to the great hall, awaiting the Sun Prince. Once, twice, thrice. From the far side a spear butt rapped upon the doors, and they fell open at the third blow with a shivering sound from the musician's timbals. He stood in the doorway, the Sun Prince. He was a vision in cloth of gold, gilding his doublet and hosen, even his boots. His cloak was cloth of gold, falling to sweep the parquet floor as he entered. The mask of a smiling youth, gleaming with gold leaf, hid his face, and its rays hid his head. I heard murmurs and speculation as he strode the length of the colonnade, gilded spear in hand. At the head of it he bowed, but as he rose so did the head of his spear, sweeping up to touch the breast of the Winter Queen. Bowing her head, she let fall her blackthorn staff. It clattered in the silence. With both hands she raised her mask and swept the wig from her head, shrugging free of her encumbering rags and shawl. I gasped, for the Winter Queen was young and beautiful, and she was Suria. But the mask was not done. The Sun Prince dropped to one knee, grasping the hand of the Winter Queen. In one swift motion he drew forth a ring and thrust it upon her finger, harshly, for I saw her wince. He rose then, grasping her hand, and turned to face the crowd. When he lifted his mask, we saw. It was Prince Baudouin. After a brief, indrawn breath of surprise, the knight's crier swung his baton and struck the gong a resounding blow, letting the tocsin give shuddering voice to the new year, and the trumpets leapt into the void of silence with a brassy shout, proclaiming joy to all. And in that indrawn moment of surprise, the celebrants found their breath, shouting with the trumpets, hailing the daring of one drunken young prince of the blood. And then the exhausted musicians found a new surge of energy, and their maestro tapped his toe, and they swung into a lively tune. Somehow, amidst it all, my gaze settled on Anarfiel Delaunay. He was watching them. Lovely and bewildered Suria, her ringed hand held aloft by the prince, with his wild gleaming eyes. And behind the wise, rustic mask of Faunus, Delaunay's features were composed and thoughtful. Such was my introduction to politics. Chapter 6. After the midwinter mask, you may be sure the weeks could not pass quickly enough for me until my 10th birthday. Now more than ever I was without place in Sirius House, no longer fit for the nursery, but too young for the fosterlings and apprentices, among whom I was never to be numbered anyway. The house was abuzz with the events of the mask, seeing in Prince Baudouin's audacity the portent of a return to days of yore, when the scions of Eloa freely sought pleasure and counsel of the servants of Nama. This much I learned. Baudouin was nephew to the king, by way of his royal sister, Princess Lionette, who was wed to Marc, Duke de Trevelyan. He was only 19, and had earned a name for wildness at the University of Tiberium, where he had been suspended for unnamed escapades. Beyond this I knew little. Hyacinth told me that it was rumoured in Knight's doorstep that there had been, unlikely as it seemed, two wagers placed on Baudouin de Trevelyan to play the role of the Sun Prince, and no one, not even he, knew in whose pocket the considerable sums had been paid. Other than this, there had been much money lost, and the backers at the counting-houses had grown fat on this longest night. When the chill of winter began to give grudging way to the moist warmth of spring, and the faintest haze of pale green clung to the branches, I turned 10. For children of the night court, this was a grand and solemn occasion. It is upon this day that one moves out of the nursery and into the fosterlings' quarter to live side by side with those favoured apprentices who have come of age and been initiated into the mysteries of Nama, who, it is said, will whisper secrets in the small hours of the night of the training they have begun. One takes the name of one's household, and there is a celebration, with watered wine and the ceremonial breaking of a honey cake, which is shared by the adepts of one's house. I was accorded none of this. Instead, as before, I was sent to attend in the Dalwain's receiving room, where I once again knelt, abeyant, upon the cushion. Anarfiel Delaunay was there, and the Dalwain, and Jareth, her second. She had grown older and querulous, and I noted from beneath my lashes how her hand shook as she held the papers to review.
"Everything is in order," Jareth said soothingly, patting her hand.
He cast an impatient glance toward the doorway, where the Chancellor of the House lurked with the official guild seal.
"You have but to sign, and Phaedra has to leave to go with my Lord Delaunay."
"Should have asked for more," the Dalwain complained.
Her voice was louder than she thought it, as happens with the elderly. Anarfiel Delaunay laid a hand on my head, briefly stroking my curls. I dared an upward glance, and saw him smiling reassuringly. The Dalwain signed with a shaky hand, the crabbed veins blew through her fine old skin, and the Chancellor of the House glided forward with his taper, to stamp the official guild seal on the documents, certifying that all had been executed within the laws of the Guild of the Servants of Narmar.
"Done,"
Jareth bowed, palms together, touching his fingertips to his lips. There was a merriment to him these days that spilled out at the slightest provocation, born of the surety that the Dowainship of Sirius House was nearly in his lap.
"May Narmar bless your enterprise, my Lord Delaunay. It has been a pleasure."
"The pleasure has been mine," Delaunay said smoothly, returning his bow, though not as to an equal.
"Miriam," he said to the Dowain in a graver tone, "I wish you health."
"Bah!"
She dismissed him and beckoned to me.
"Phaedra."
I rose as I had been taught and knelt at her chair, suddenly terrified that she would recant. But her crabbed hand rose to smooth my cheek, and her eyes, no less steely behind the room that veiled them, searched my face.
"Should have asked for more,"
she repeated almost kindly. They say that money is one of the few pleasures that endure, and I understood that, despite everything, this was a blessing of sorts. Of a sudden I felt great tenderness for the old woman who had taken me in when my own mother had cast me out, and I leaned into her caress.
"Phaedra,"
Delaunay said gently, and I remembered that I had a new master and rose obediently. He smiled pleasantly at Jareth.
"Have her things brought to my coach."
Jareth bowed. And so I took my leave of Sirius House and the night court unto which I was born. I don't know what I expected in Delaunay's coach. Whatever I expected, it did not happen. His coach awaited in the forecourt an elegant trap drawn by a matched foursome of blood bays. An apprentice brought the small bundle that contained such things as I might call my own, which was little more than nothing, and which the coachman stowed in the back. Delaunay preceded me, patting the velvet cushions to indicate I should sit. He waved out the window to the coachman, and we set out at a good clip, whereupon he settled back into his seat and drew the curtain partially closed. I sat on tenterhooks, waiting and wondering. Nothing happened. Delaunay, for his part, ignored me, humming to himself and gazing out the half-curtained window. After a while I tired of waiting for something to occur, and scooted to the window on my side, twitching the curtain back. When I was scarce more than a babe in arms, I had seen the world, but since I had been 4 years old, I'd not ventured past night's doorstep. Now I looked out the window, and saw the city of Eloa roll past my view and rejoiced. The streets seemed clean and new, the parks ready to burst into spring, and the houses and temples all aspired upward in joyous defiance of the earth. We crossed the river, and the bright sails of trade ships made my heart sing. The coach took us to an elegant quarter of the city, near to the palace, though on the outskirts. Through a narrow gate we went, and into a modest courtyard. The coachman drew up and came around to open the door. Delaunay descended, and I hesitated, uncertain, gazing past his shoulder at a simple, elegant townhouse. The door opened, and a figure not much larger than myself emerged at a run, caught himself, and proceeded at a more decorous pace. I stared from the coach at the most beautiful boy I had ever seen. His hair was white, and for those who never knew Alcuin, I say this in earnest. It was white, whiter than a snow fox's pelt. It fell like silk over his shoulders, in a river of moonlight. An albino, one might suppose, and indeed his skin was surpassingly fair. But his eyes were dark as pansies at midnight. I, raised amid pearls of beauty, gaped. On the far side of Delaunay, he fretted with impatience, a smile at once kind and eager lighting his dark eyes. I had forgotten that Delaunay already had a pupil.
"Alcuin."
I could hear the affection in Delaunay's voice. It churned my gut. He put his hand on the boy's shoulder and turned to me.
"This is Phaedra. Make her welcome."
I exited the coach, stumbling. He took my hands in his, cool and smooth, and kissed me in greeting. I could feel Delaunay's wry smile at a distance. A liveried servant emerged from the house to pay the coachman and take my small bundle, and Delaunay steered us gently inward. The boy, Alcuin, kept hold of my hand, tugging lightly. Inside, Delaunay's house was gracious and pleasant. Another servant in livery bowed, which I scarce noticed, and Alcuin dropped my hand to scamper ahead, glancing back with a quick, eager smile. Already I hated him for what he knew of our mutual master. We passed through several rooms into an inner sanctum, a gardened courtyard, where a terrace of early greening vines threw verdant shadows on the flagstones, and a fountain played. There was a niche with a statue of Eloa, and a table laid with iced melons and pale grapes. Alcuin spun in a circle, flinging out his arms. "For you, Fedra," he cried, laughing. "Welcome!" He dropped onto one of the reclining couches, set about in a conversational circle, wrapped his arms around himself and grinned. An unobtrusive servant glided into the courtyard, pouring chilled wine for Delaunay and cool water for Alcuin and myself.
"Welcome," Delaunay seconded the toast, smiling, gauging my reaction. "Eat, drink, sit."
I took a slice of melon and perched on the edge of a couch, watching them both, patently uncomfortable with the undefined nature of my role here. Delaunay reclined, at leisure, looking amused, and Alcuin followed his lead, looking merry with anticipation. I could not help but glance around, looking for a kneeling cushion. There was none.
"We do not stand or kneel on ceremony in my household, Fedra," Delaunay said kindly, reading my mind. "It is one thing to observe the courtesies of rank, and quite another to treat humans as chattel."
I looked up to meet his eyes. "You own my mark," I said bluntly.
"Yes."
He gave me that gauging look.
"But I do not own you. And when one day your mark is made, I would have you remember me as one who lifted you up and not cast you down. Do you understand?"
I plucked at a button on the velvet cushioning of the couch. "You like people to owe you favors." There was a pause, and then he gave the startling bark of laughter I'd heard before, Alcuin's higher laugh echoing above it.
"Yes," Delaunay said thoughtfully, "you might say that. Although I like to think I am a humanist, too, in the tradition of Blessed Eloa."
He shrugged, dismissing the matter in his amused fashion.
"I am told you have learned somewhat of the Kedaki tongue."
"I have read all of Telicus the Elder and half the Younger," I retorted, nettled by his attitude. I did not mention the poetry of Felice Dolophilus.
"Good," he was unperturbed. "You're none too far behind Alcuin, then. You can take your lessons together. Have you other languages?" "No? No matter. When you've settled in, I'll arrange for you to start lessons in Skaldic and Cruinia."
My head swam. I picked up my plate of melon and set it back down. "My Lord Delaunay," I said, choosing my words carefully, "is it not your will that I shall be apprenticed unto the service of Nama?"
"Oh, that."
With a wave of his hand he discarded the tenets of the night court.
"You can sing, I'm told, and play a passable harp. The Dawain says you've an ear for poetry. I'll hire a tutor to continue your teaching in such arts until you come of age and may decide for yourself if you wish to serve Nama. But there are other matters of more import."
I sat up straight on the couch. "The arts of the salon are of the utmost import, my lord."
"No."
His grey eyes glinted.
"They have value, Fedra, and that is all. But what I will teach you, you will like, I think. You will learn to look, to see, and to think, and there is merit in such lessons as will last a lifetime."
"You will teach me what already I know," I said, sullen.
"Will I indeed?"
Delaunay leaned back on the couch and popped a grape into his mouth.
"Tell me then about the coach in which we rode here, Fedra.
Describe it to me.
It was a black coach. I glared at him. A coach and four with matched bays, with red velvet on the seats, gold braid on the curtains, and sateen stripes on the walls.
Well done.
He glanced at Alcuin.
And you?
The boy sat up cross-legged on the couch. It was a coach for hire, he said promptly, because there was no insignia on the door, and the driver wore plain clothes and not livery. A wealthy hostelry, most like, because the horses were well-bred and matched. Nor were they lathered, so most like you leased them here in the city. The driver was between 18 and 22, and country-bred to judge from his hat. But he has been in the city long enough to need no direction, nor bite good coin when paid him by a gentleman. He carried no other passengers, and left straight away, so I would gauge you were his only fare to-day, my lord. If I were to seek your identity and your business, my lord, I think it would not be so hard to find the driver of this coach and four, and make inquiries. His dark eyes danced with the pleasure of having answered well. There was no malice in it. De Launay smiled at him.
And better done, he said, then glanced at me. Do you see?
I muttered something. I don't know what.
This is the training I will ask of you, Fedra, he said, his voice sterner. You will learn to look, to see, and to think on what you see. You asked me at midwinter if I knew you by your eyes, and I said no. I did not need to see the mote in your eye, to know you were one who had been stricken by Cushiel's dart. It was in every line of your body, as you gazed after the dominatrices of Mandrake House. It is to the glory of Elawa and his companions, in whose veins your blood flows. Even as a child you bear the mark of it. In time you may become it, do you choose. But understand, my sweet, that this is only a beginning. Now do you see?
His face acquired a particular beauty when he put on that expression, stern and serious, like the portraits of old provincial nobles who could trace their lineage straight back to one of Elawa's companions in an unbroken line. Yes, my lord, I said, adoring him for it. If Anarfiel de Launay wanted me to lay down in the stews, like Nama, I would do it, I was sure. And if he willed me to be more than an instrument for Mandragian fiddle-players, I would learn to be it. I thought on his words to me that longest night, and a connection formed in my mind as easily as a nursing babe finds the nipple. My lord, I asked him, did you place a wager in Knight's doorstep that Baudouin de Trevallion would play the Sun Prince? Once more I was rewarded with his unexpected shout of laughter, longer this time, unchecked. Alcuin grinned and hugged his knees with glee. At last de Launay wrestled his mirth under control, removing a kerchief from his pocket and dabbing his eyes.
Ah, Fedra, he sighed, Miriam was right. She should have asked for more.
Chapter 7. So began the years of my long apprenticeship with Anarfiel de Launay, wherein I began to learn how to look and see and think. And lest anyone should suppose that my time was taken with nothing more taxing than watching and heeding my surroundings, I may assure you this was the least of it, if not the least important. As de Launay had indicated, I studied languages, Caerdyche until I could speak it in my dreams, and Cruinia, for which I saw no need, and Skaldic, recalling to me the long-ago tribesman who had appointed himself my guardian on the trader's road. Alcuin, it transpired, spoke Skaldic with some long-imprinted skill, for it had been his milk-tongue, spoken to him in the cradle by a Skaldic wet-nurse. In truth, it was she who had saved him from an ambush by her own people, and given him unto de Launay's keeping, but this I learned later. In addition to languages, we were made to study history, until my head ached with it. We traced civilization from the golden age of Hellas to the rise of Tiberium, and followed her fall, dealt two-fisted by twin claimants. The followers of Yeshua held that his coming was a prophecy,
that Tiberium should fall, and they should restore the throne of the one god. Historians, Delaunay told us guardedly, held that the dispersal of Yeshuite financiers from the city of Tiberium had more to do with it. Strained coffers, he maintained, were what eventually caused the great empire of Tiberium to be divided into the loose-knit republic of nation-states that comprises Caedica Unitas. The second blow, no less doughty, was struck against the once mighty Tiberian armies on the green island of Alba, when there rose amid the warring factions a tribal king named Cinel Arp Donal, known as Cinel Rú, who succeeded in making a treaty with the Dalriada of Era and uniting the tribes against the emperor's armies. Thus did the island come once and for all under the rule of the Cruinia, whom scholars call the Picti. They are a wild, half-civilized folk, and I saw no need to learn their tongue. Once the Tiberian soldiers were driven out of Alba, they began retreating and never stopped, driven out of the Scaldic hinterlands by berserkers, and, legends claimed, the spirits of raven and wolf. Through this blood-stained tapestry ran the history of Terre d'Ange, shining like a golden thread. A peaceful land, content to fruit and flower beneath the blessed sun, we had no history, Delaunay said, before the coming of Eloa. We gave way with grace before the armies of Tiberium, who ate our grapes and olives, wed our women, and held our borders against the Scaldi. We carried out our small rituals unchanged, and kept our language and our songs unchanging. When the armies of Tiberium retreated like a wave across our lands, into the waiting emptiness came the wandering steps of Eloa, and the land welcomed him like a bridegroom. Thus was born Terre d'Ange, and thus did we acquire history and pride. In the 80 years of Eloa, the companions dispersed, placing their numinous stamp on the land and its people. Blessed Eloa himself claimed no portion, but delighted to roam at will, a wandering bridegroom in love with all he saw. When he tarried, it was in the city, which is why she is the queen of all cities, and beloved in the nation, but he tarried seldom. All this I knew, and yet it was a different thing to learn it from Delaunay. Not stories, but histories. For this too I learned, that a storyteller's tale may end, but history goes on always. These events, so distant in legend, play a part in shaping the very events we witness about us, each and every day. When I understood this, Delaunay said, I might begin to understand. What I was to understand, it seemed, was everything. It was not until I began to study the labyrinthine maze of court politics that I truly despaired of my sheltered life in the night court. Alcuin had been learning such things for 2 years and more, and could effortlessly recite the lineage of each of the 7 sovereign duchies, the royal family and its myriad entanglements, the duties of the exchequer, the limits of judiciary powers, even the bylaws of the Guild of Spice Trading. For this, as for so much else, I despised him. And yet I admit freely that I loved him too. It was impossible not to love Alcuin, who loved nigh the entire world. Unlikely as it seemed, to one raised in the night court, he was unaware of his startling beauty, which only increased as he got older. He had a quicksilver mind and a prodigious memory, which I envied, and yet he took no pride in it, save the pride of pleasing Delaunay. When Delaunay entertained, which in those days was often, it was Alcuin who waited on his guests. In contrast to the revels and delights staged by Sirius House, these were civilized, erudite affairs. What Delaunay liked best was to invite a small number of friends, who would recline on couches, a la Helene, in the inner courtyard, enjoying an elegant meal and spinning out the night in convivial conversation. Alcuin stood by to serve wine or cordial at these affairs, and while I was contemptuous of his lack of sophistication, I could not deny that he was a charming sight. All untutored grace and gentle eagerness, the vine-cast shadows throwing traceries of green on his moon-white hair. When Alcuin proffered the wine-jug with his grave smile, as like as not, guests smiled back and raised their glasses, whether they wished them refilled or no, merely to see the pleasure of serving light his dark eyes. This, of course, was Delaunay's intent, and I've no doubt that many a tongue was loosened in that courtyard by virtue of Alcuin's smile. I have never known a mind more subtle than that of Anarfield Delaunay. Yet to those who cite such things as proof that he used us without regard, I say, it is a lie. Of a surety we loved him, both of us in our differing ways, and I have no doubt in my mind that Delaunay loved us in turn. I would have proof enough of that ere things were done, little though I welcomed it at the time. As for the guests, they varied, and so widely it scarce seemed possible that one man could have so many acquaintances from such far-flung quarters of the nation. He chose his guests with great care, and never did I see a mix that soured, unless it was at his will. Delaunay knew court officials and judiciaries, lords and ladies, shippers and traders, poets and painters and moneylenders. He knew singers and warriors and goldsmiths, breeders of the finest horse-flesh, scholars and historians, silk merchants and milliners. He knew scions of Blessed Eloa and his companions, and members of all the great houses. I learned that Gaspard Trevelyan, Comte de Fossé, and kinsman to Marc Duc de Trevelyan, was a great friend of his. A clever, cynical man, with streaks of grey at his temples, Gaspard was adept at sniffing the political winds to see which way they blew. It was he, doubtless, who had told Delaunay how the Princess Lionette whispered in her son Baudouin's ear about an ailing king and an empty throne, and the portent people might take from the symbolic wedding at the midwinter masque. Such things surrounded me and were a part of my life on a daily basis, for what I did not observe I later learned when Delaunay obtained Alcuin's recitation of a night's events. He was ever scrupulous in including me during these sessions, that I might increase the knowledge that already crammed my aching skull. For a long time I resented his favouritism of Alcuin, when I was better trained to serve, but even so, I listened. I understood later why he held me back during those first long years. Those whom Delaunay would choose for his clientele would be chosen with care. They were among the elite, and mistrustful of the nation, too deeply embroiled in money and power to be lured easily into spilling pillow secrets. With Alcuin, Delaunay was wise enough to set the wheels of desire in motion long before the day would arrive. There were nobles who yearned for years, watching him grow with tantalizing slowness from a beautiful child to a breathtaking youth. When they spilled their secrets, there were years of pressure behind the force that burst the dam. With me, it was different. The desire that I elicited, would elicit, burned hotter, and with a shorter fuse. Delaunay, who knew much of human nature, knew this, and chose in his wisdom to keep me a secret from his guests. Word spread, as was inevitable, that he had taken a second pupil. When his guests pressed him to reveal my nature, he smiled and demurred. Thus did my reputation spread, while I toiled toward adolescence, immersed in the labours of ink and parchment. There was one exception, Melisande. Genius requires an audience. For all his cleverness, Delaunay was an artist, and as vulnerable as any of his kind, to the desire to vaunt his brilliance. And there were few, very few people capable of appreciating his art. I did not know then how deep laid a game they played with each other, nor what part in it I was to play. All I knew was that she was the audience he chose. I had been 3 years and a half in his household, and had been some time training with a tumbling master Delaunay had found Eloa knows where. He believed, Delaunay did, in a balanced approach to shaping one's nature, and thus were Alcuin and I subjected to an endless series of physical training, to ensure that our well-honed minds were ensconced in vigorous bodies. I had just finished my day's lesson, in which I had learnt to throw a standing somersault, and was toweling off the sweat, when Delaunay entered the gymnasium with her. The tumbling master was packing his things, and seeing her, bid to make a hasty retreat, which Delaunay ignored. To describe Melisande Shari's eye is, as the poets say, to paint a nightingale's song. It is a thing which cannot be done. She was 23 years of age at that time, though time never seemed to touch her, either way it flowed. If I say her skin was like alabaster, her hair a black so true it gleamed blue where the light touched it, and her eyes a sapphire that gemstones might envy, I speak only the truth. But she was a d'Angeline, and this only hints at the beginning of beauty.
"Melisande," de Launay said, pride and amusement in his voice, "this is Phaedra."
"As I am d'Angeline and night-court born, you may be sure I am not easily awed by beauty. But I am what I am, and there are other things that awe me." The Sharizai are an ancient house of courtiers, and many, knowing little of the nomenclature of Terre d'Ange, suppose they are of Shemhazai's lineage. It is not so. The namesakes among the descendants of Eloa's companions are intertwined in such a way that only a d'Angeline scholar can comprehend them. I, who had studied such things, had no need of history to tell me House Sharizai's lineage. When I glanced up politely to meet the blue eyes of Melisande Shari'zai, her look went through me like a spear, my knees turned to water, and I knew that she was a scion of Kushiel.
"How charming!"
She crossed the gymnasium floor with careless grace, sweeping the train of her gown over one arm. Cool fingers stroked my cheek, lacquered nails trailing lightly over my skin. I shuddered. With a faint smile she held my chin up, forcing me to look her in the face.